difference does it make that we are here? I'd like to share a story about my darling cousin Bess, who passed away this past spring at the extraordinary age of 92. As a matter of fact, I'm not even related to cousin Bess. She emigrated to the U.S. during the Depression and was taken in by my mother's family. But she is family. Loved as she was, missed deeply since she's gone. Bess had been an Anglican in Canada, and so an Episcopalian in the USA. She was very devout, so enthusiastic about her head position on the altar guild that she earned the nickname The Bishop from her church, her small town, and her priest, who was lost without her direction every Sunday. Bess was outspoken. Despite being a staunch Republican, she marched with us, or I should say toddled behind a wheelchair with us, against the war in Iraq at a 4th of July parade just a few years before her death. She was one of the women in my family who profoundly influenced me growing up. Now, one day when I was quite young, we were crouched in the backyard weeding her strawberries together. "Well," she snorted, "what do you think about your parents taking you to that Unitarian church?" "I don't know, Aunt Bess," I said. At the time, I was taught to call her Aunt Bess out of respect for our age differences. "What should I think?" I asked her. "Well," she said, "they're no better than those Jews." "I didn't know there was anything wrong with the Jews," I said, and she dropped the issue right there. And that was my first lesson that being a UU made a difference in my attitude towards interfaith relations. Growing up in a family that had Unitarian and Universalist roots going back several hundred years, one that became a UU family along with the whole denomination in 1962 means I had the amazing privilege of being introduced to other religions in a very different way than most of my peers, including many UUs I have encountered during my adult life and ministry. They came to us in order to leave a damaging or what they felt was an inadequate religious faith behind. Our UU religious educationist children did not teach us to be suspicious of other faiths. I was taken to their places of worship regularly by my parents and my religious education program. We felt welcome and unthreatened there. Not being in recovery from another faith means that those who were UU children usually didn't have the impulse to reject certain beliefs, practices, or religions out of hand because they represented something they were trying to leave behind, unless they were specifically taught that by their parents. Neither are childhood UU's secularized versions of another faith finding themselves more comfortable in the humanism of a UU congregation, but still carrying a sword against the conflicts of a previous faith. We were taught to stand our ground before anyone who would try to demean our religion, but not to insist that it was a superior. As a result, I don't really feel the need to cross God or Jesus out of the hymnal. As a somewhat militant agnostic, I really don't feel uncomfortable in public prayer, even when someone prays to God or in Jesus' name for my sake. I can accept Holy Communion and other rites not my own when they are offered to me as part of the hospitality of a faith group where I am a guest, regardless of whether I subscribe to the official dogma behind those rites. Now, that is not to say that I couldn't go head to head with someone who tries to convert me, and I wouldn't hold forth for hours about why that faith is not my faith, or preach about the clay feet of any religious authority. But generally, I was taught to accept, respect, and value other religions just as they are. Now I appreciate this as one of the profound gifts Unitarian Universalism has given me as an individual and one of the greatest assets it has given my community ministry. I can meet people spiritually and religiously where they are, without the compulsion to convert or shame them. Religious understanding goes far deeper than mentioning other religions and their scriptures in our Sunday school and worship services. It means acceptance, not arrogance, rubbing shoulders, not isolationism, because those positive kinds of actions are necessary for peace. Now, I'm very fortunate to be living in the Milwaukee area, as there is an active interfaith organization here, the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. The Interfaith Conference is a nonprofit organization consisting of regional leaders and supporters of 13 member faiths and denominations. It focuses on building interfaith relationships, bringing interfaith education to increase public understanding, and providing a venue for faiths to work together on social justice issues, especially those that improve the quality of life for those in poverty. It also brings together non-member faiths to join in its many programs and activities, and in short, strives to be a unified voice of moral conscience. Now, I hope the members of the Interfaith and its supporters are listed in your order of service. Did that make it in there? Yeah. And I really wanted you to see that Interfaith Conference is truly interfaith. It is not simply ecumenical Christian. The Interfaith Conference was originally formed in 1970 out of two organizations that addressed racial equality in housing, public education, and employment during the social upheavals of the 1960s. We UUs were with them almost from the very beginning. We were just two or three congregations then. But the Interfaith Conference encouraged us to form SUIC, the Southeastern Wisconsin Unitarian Universalist Congregations, so that we could stand together equally with denominations many times our size. We all get three representatives apiece. That gives us, as UUs, enormous potential. Now, the founders of Interfaith marched with Father James Grappi in the early 60s in protest of massive racial inequality and segregation. In the 70s, task groups were formed around desegregation of public schools, housing, the environmental crisis, racial equality, training clergy about poverty, and media relations. The Interfaith Conference created an alternative service program to employ conscientious objectors to the war in Vietnam. It instituted the Interfaith Program for Older Adults, which is now independent of the conference and provides for the major needs of our older citizens. The conference also began an ethnic heritage project to provide a guide to ethnic resources in the Milwaukee area. That was just the 1970s. In the 1980s, the conference organized the first Greater Milwaukee Crop Walk with Church World Service. This anti-hunger program continues to grow and has spread to outlying suburbs and counties. The Religion and Labor Committee formed, sponsoring annual conferences and national speakers in the interest of fair wages and labor practices. The Interfaith Fund for Jobs provided loans to small businesses to create jobs, and the Peace and International Issues Committee first began voicing opposition to U.S. policy regarding Nicaragua, El Salvador, and South Africa. The Congregation Action Network formed and continues to this day to help congregations advocate for responsible and just public policy on issues important to low-income families. Also during the 80s, the Interfaith Conference helped to create MICA, the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, by letting organizers and donors use the conference's tax-exempt status. Now, during the 1990s, the conference issued an interfaith plea for justice in response to the Desert Storm Iraq invasion and launched Beyond Racism, which creates multicultural dialogues and offers extensive anti-racism training programs, including the Common Ground Anti-Racism Conference held with UW-Milwaukee for many years. In 1994, the Beyond Racism Children's Program resulted in the production of the Alike and Different curriculum, a big seller nationally to UU congregations. It has reached its third edition and teaches children to understand and value differences through stories, songs, games, and fun activities. In 1995, the conference welcomed Archbishop Desmond Tutu as its speaker at its 25th anniversary celebration. And in that year, the Milwaukee Association for Interfaith Relations, or MAIR, came under the umbrella of the Interfaith Conference as one of its programs, bringing with it more groups of Buddhists, Muslims, Sikhs, Jains, and Baha'i, who joined the Catholics, many Protestants, Jews, Quakers, and Unitarians already in the conference. In the 90s, the Interfaith Conference and others had begun to coordinate the emergency overflow shelter for women and children when welfare reform deprived them of their homes. Through the planning efforts of the Interfaith Conference and its partners, 7 years later, this program spun off and moved into a newly renovated cathedral center in downtown Milwaukee, where it continues to provide not just a place to sleep, but homeless recovery services for women and children. In 2001, the Interfaith Conference and MAIR sponsored a packed downtown Milwaukee Interfaith Prayer Service for Peace in response to the attacks of September 11th. In 2007, after a multi-year cooperative effort, the Interfaith Conference and other groups succeeded in having Milwaukee create a housing trust fund, which built support for affordable housing into the municipal tax structure. And I understand this has now been taken up here in Waukesha County. Also in 2007, after 30 years of concern with environmental issues, the conference launched the Faith and Ecology Project Network with Tomorrow's Present and the Urban Ecology Center, eventually forming the current Interfaith Earth Network, or IEN. The Interfaith Conference has been a strong vehicle for the entire community to be active in issues and concerns that all UUs share. It gives us a network and means to put numbers of people behind issues of social justice that UU and other congregations, small as they are not able to do alone. The past few years demonstrated the need for even more deep and educational dialogue in order to help push back against the alarming tide of interfaith hatred being promoted by reactionary media. After experiencing a great deal of distress over divisiveness between some of its members in 2009, in 2010, its 40th anniversary year, Interfaith Conference launched two new programs to get people from every faith and no faith at all to in face-to-face contact with each other for dialogue and interfaith understanding. One of these programs is the new Interfaith Book Discussion Group, which in fall 2010 read and discussed The Faith Club, a book written by a Jewish, Christian, and a Muslim woman about how they came to a deep understanding of each other's faith through dialogue post 9/11. As one of the conveners of this book group, it came home to me again just how important it is for UUs to be present for interfaith dialogue. As I heard words about the inherent worth and dignity of all people being mouthed by everyone. The second program, which is being launched this January and February, involves bringing the Amazing Faiths Dinners Project to Milwaukee. In this program, 8 to 12 people of different religions or no religion at all sit down together at a simple meal and with the guidance of a trained moderator, learn to listen deeply to each other's faith journey without criticism, judgment, or debate, and also to have a place to articulate their own spiritual journey. Information forms for both of these groups, if you're interested, are on the back radiator there. Now, our own UU theologian, Forrest Church, from whose books many of us draw much courage and inspiration, wrote at length in his work, The Cathedral of the World, about our acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. He said, "We are bound by the shared recognition that when one person suffers, all suffer. When we violate one life, all lives are violated. When we pollute the earth, all living things are stained. When one nation threatens the security of another, it too becomes less secure. When we place the planet in mortal danger, we hazard the future of our own children as well as the children of our enemies. Church points out that we all have prejudices, and if thoughtful people don't work hard at these prejudices, bigots, those who celebrate prejudice, will only be vested with more power. Church offers the idea that the way to counter fear with faith is to start with our own prejudices, because we can do something about those. He says, we did nothing to deserve being born. We did nothing to earn life's privileges of joy and pain. And on the day we die, we still know almost nothing about what life was all about. So what do? Do we name our stars and shake our heads in humility and wonder? No. We sit on a single grain of sand on this vast cosmic beach and argue over who has the goods on God, the atheist or the atheist. We duel sometimes to the death over which religious teacher has the best insider information. Now, people learn their religion before they are old enough to judge, or they are converted, often under stressful or unendurable times in their lives, where the conversion is seen as both liberating and enlivening, snatching them back from a pit of despair. Up against that origin, challenges to personal beliefs elicit a visceral and emotional response that is exacerbated by a fear that should the challenges present a worldview capable of toppling our own, that the very ground of the cosmos will shift under us. Humans fight against those kinds of ground-shifting changes, often with their own lives. Now, all of the sectarian conflicts worldwide ask us to consider what the role of the onlooker is when two religions have conflict. In a fractured community, it is either to take sides and vehemently support the destruction of one side by the other, or to stay out of the way, guiltily trying to ignore the atrocities while waiting for a victor to emerge and then rewriting history to grant them just cause. In a diverse yet just and connected community, the role of the onlooker would be different. And this is where it matters that we, you, yous are here as people whose covenant with the world is to respect the inherent worth and dignity of all humans, heed the words of prophetic women and men, and draw inspiration from the many facets of religion. It matters that we could take the lead for developing synergy and conversion, not in the sense of converting other religions to ours, but in the sense of converting all of us to peace. Doing the excruciating work of peacemaking acknowledges the hurts of the past, but tries to bring both sides to make a disciplined decision to leave retaliation behind in support of opening a future of life and peace for all the children involved. This requires a bringing together of the combatants in real hospitality, real talk, real honesty, to delve deeper beyond the restrictions of jingoistic religious or political loyalty. Gustav Niebuhr, in his book Beyond Tolerance, the book being studied by our interfaith book group this spring, points out the critical challenge of our age. He says, we live in an era not simply of religious violence, but one in which bitter divisions are painfully evident and often gratuitously cultivated. That's especially true in national politics, in which rhetoric is often suffused with partisan rage. Public debate seems laced with poison. In Congress, and even more so on television and the internet, such rough trade in raw insult denies the possibility that we might share anything like a common life. In such circumstances, it is remarkable that some people would try to use religion, or rather different religions, to create not explosive divisions, but rather a sense of community. But Niebuhr's research explores just that. The great outpouring of help during the 9/11/2001 tragedy. He says another force was at work amid the horror, a constructive force, alive at the grassroots, defined by neighborliness and an active commitment to the preservation of peace and the safety and rights of vulnerable people. Some people had taken America's emerging religious diversity and sought to create a community of it. This was the community that rushed to the rescue, not only of those in the World Trade Center, but of mosques in Muslims and Sikhs in Sikh temples guilty by association simply because they were seen wearing turbans. These groups became targets of violence as a result of the perpetrators of the attack identifying themselves as Muslim and the reactionary media running wild with that. The neighborly community, by far the dominant response to the tragedy, is the piece that has been intentionally left out of the ensuing conversation of fear dominated by Fox Media and its imitators ever since. It is the neighborly community that has chosen to not only question, but to work against the far-right propaganda that would have all of us turn upon our Muslim neighbors and brand them terrorists. This is but one example of the vision of community that makes UU involvement in interfaith relations not only right, but an imperative for us. But that imperative is not simply a passive call for tolerance. As Niebuhr declares, tolerance can be a shallow foundation on which to construct a community. Toleration serves as a basis for a ceasefire, but it does not offer a vision of what might follow. Dialogue is an activity that represents a state of relations going well beyond tolerance. To put it simply, you can coexist with people without ever having to speak meaningfully with them. What holds society together is not just people who will tolerate others, but people who will actually go beyond that to provide the glue that nourishes social relationships. You cannot truly be concerned about human rights unless you believe that each individual has an inherent worth and dignity. And to assume that is to do more than simply tolerate people. It is to extend to them a recognition of their uniqueness. Now, I hear the very first one of our principles and purposes talking here. And in this, I hear a call for UUs to enter boldly into the cause of interfaith relations. The truth is, we have not, really. Our denomination statistics tell us that less than 1 in 10 UU congregations have engaged in any sort of interfaith activity. So often, what anyone takes from their own religion is to feel superior about it, and to believe that those who don't share it are misguided, unintelligent, ignorant, just plain stupid, or going to hell. Now, we must admit that we UUs can have our own enlightened version of that dynamic. We have often been talking the superficial talk of tolerance, but we have not largely been walking the walk of deeper interfaith understanding. We are not to wait, passively mouthing tolerance until people find their way to us because they have traded their religion for ours. We are enjoined to do a better job of getting ourselves out of our sometimes religiously arrogant or economically determined isolation from the Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and above all, Christians and others around us. Even if we have to travel to accept their hospitality and learn from them in their own places of worship, it is incumbent upon us to do so in order to live out the principles of our own faith. The interdependent web of all existence is not just about trees and flowers. It's also about our hospitable and deep listening and dialogue with people who are not religiously like us. We learned from the Faith Club book that when we feel bruised by the crises of our differences, we can be healed by the generosity and compassion of our similarities. But we have to take the risk of reaching inward together for those similarities and cultivating them. Now, I've noticed that despite the amazingly progressive philosophical underpinnings of our Yuyi religion, often, even in our own churches, we know very little about the spirituality of our own pew neighbors. We have to ask ourselves, is our congregation a place whose tolerance rituals actually isolate us from others? A place where we never really talk about what we believe for fear of offending others or being criticized ourselves? Or is it a faith club, like the one described in the book, where superiority and fear are set aside and we listen deeply to each other's spiritual center without barging in to correct or challenge, either outwardly by interrupting and arguing, or inwardly when we unconsciously stop listening to another because we immediately compare their beliefs to our own and dismiss them as wanting? If we have not even shared individual spirituality between the pews in our congregation, it is fair for us to ask of ourselves, have we given a fair shake to other religions at all? Have we made it make a difference that we, with our theoretically inclusive principles and purposes, are actually here, living out inclusivity and dialogue and understanding?